I first started coming to this church in, I think, the early 1990s. For a while, I went back and forth between the Quakers and the Unitarians, but I found a home here. Until that was my old friend Bill, who's probably watching us on the webcam. My old friend Bill Darlison persuaded me to go and get myself trained for ministry. So shortly before I went off to train, I had to go off to the UK. Shortly before I went off, several members of the congregation had made contributions to what was then on RTE1 Thought for the Day. There was a little 2-minute snippet during the morning news of spiritual content. And usually one person went in and recorded 5 little snippets, and they were played on the radio Monday to Friday. So I'd been invited to go and record a series of these, which I did, and it was well received, and I was paid for it, which was very nice. And then I took myself off to Oxford, where I started studying for my ministry training. And some time later, I received an email saying, we wonder if you might like to record some more Thoughts for the Day. I thought, oh, that's very flattering. They must have liked what I did before. And I said, well, unfortunately, I'm not in Ireland anymore. I'm in the UK. I'm in Oxford. And they said, oh, well, that's okay. We can book you a place at BBC Oxford to go in and record them there. And I thought, oh, excellent. Okay. So I took myself off to... carefully wrote some scripts, and I wrote them about sort of feminine and women's spirituality. They didn't vet the scripts or anything, they just left you to your own thing. I went in and I recorded them, and sometime later I received a check in the post, which was very nice, but they were never broadcast. And I kept checking back over several months, and they never appeared on RTE. Now, my good friend Eleanor said, oh, well, it could easily just have been an administrative cock-up, somebody lost them or something else. But to me, it makes a better story from my point of view that I was censored by RTE. So since they were never heard on the national wavelengths, I have edited some of those thoughts. They're 20 years old now, but I still stand by most of what I wrote. I've edited some of them, and I'm going to share them with you today. Now, this first paragraph, I think this might have been the offending paragraph that got me censored. In April 2005, I watched, to my surprise, with complete absorption, the service of inauguration of Pope Benedict XVI as supreme earthly leader of the Roman Catholic Church. As I watched, I was more and more struck by the spectacle of row upon row upon row of hundreds, maybe even thousands, of cardinals, bishops, and priests, and every single one of them a man. I realized that even though the question of women priests had not been the reason why I moved away from the Catholic Church, there is no way that I could now belong to a spiritual community which will not accept women into the heart of its leadership and ministry. So I don't know, was that too hot to handle for RTE in 2005? But being the open and broad Unitarian that I was, I continued straight on. I am very conscious, however, that for many people, women and men, this is the community with which they walk their path towards God. And so in respect of the religious choices of others, I want to finish this particular snippet by sharing part of a prayer which I wrote in the week following the inauguration. Great God of all, bestow upon Pope Benedict XVI the spiritual gifts which he will need as he undertakes this great responsibility of leadership and care. Grant to all people the humility to know that glimpses of truth revealed to each of us are but part of the truth. As far as we in conscience can, may we honor the truth of our fellow travelers and always reach out to them in love. Wasn't enough, apparently, to get get me away from censorship. And just last month, there was in fact just an article in yesterday's Irish Times by Mary McAleese commenting on the fact that just last month, the Vatican Commission reiterated its ban on women deacons in the church. Mary McAleese, who doesn't pull her punches, talked about the rancid theology which allows the Vatican to make such statements. We believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty. The Lord is my shepherd, High King of heaven. There can be no doubt that the God of Christianity is male. The language used to address God and to speak about God by many Christians of all denominations is still resolutely male. There are, of course, many who reject the use of anthropomorphic imagery for God at all. And I'm not suggesting an acceptance of God as actually being male or female. However, in common with many religious thinkers, I affirm that the notion of God, what is God? That notion of God is so completely beyond the ability of our intellect and our language to grasp that sometimes the only way to approach God is through imagery. We could use completely gender-neutral language all of the time, but this can leave God in the realm of an indescribable concept as cold and unapproachable. For many of us, in order to approach God in our very human way, the use of some kind of imagery that maybe reminds us of the people we love, it can be helpful. And I feel that so long as there is an acceptance that this use of imagery is simply a device by which we can use language to describe a concept which is actually beyond language. Daphne Hampson, one time a professor of divinity at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, she asserted, after being a Christian for many, many years, as she studied theology more and more deeply, she came to assert that for a variety of reasons, it is not possible to be a feminist and a Christian. The two are mutually exclusive. That's one woman's point of view. Other feminist theologians have asked searching questions about the patriarchal nature of Christianity, but are deeply committed to remaining within the Christian church. So in principle, I don't have a problem with male imagery for God, but I feel it has to be balanced with an equally powerful image of God as female. When I wrote this 20 years ago, I said this: I'm not comfortable with meddling with the language of traditional prayers and hymns. For example, I'm deeply attached to Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." It's part of my history, and I find it comforting and strengthening in times of fear or uncertainty, in line with the great Unitarian concept that we don't have to, once we state something, we don't have to follow through with it. We can change our minds. I later did write my own version of the Psalm 23, changing it not very much, but changing some of the gendered language. This is how I cast it. "Love is my shepherd, I shall not want. She bids me lie down in green pastures. She leads me beside quiet waters. She restores my soul. She leads me in paths of righteousness for her name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your song and your touch, they comfort me." The original is "your rod and your staff, they comfort me." I felt your song and your touch, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the midst of my challenges. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and love shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of love forever. Very minor changes, but to me it just makes it, it doesn't make me kind of bristle with all that lording. So the contents of the New Testament, the Christian Bible, as we know it today, are a product of decisions made by church fathers. And the most important of these councils were going on around the 4th century of the Christian era. A feminist theologian, Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, she was a professor at Harvard Divinity School. She reckoned that, as is always the case in the writing of history, this canonical New Testament is a document of the historical winners. She considers that the Bible, as it has been passed down to us, is not verbally inspired revelation, but a series of historical and poetical accounts written within the context of a religious community, and therefore a product of the patriarchal culture of the time. She has referred to the example in Mark's Gospel, where the most prominent male disciples are shown not to understand the suffering messiahship of Jesus, whereas the women emerge in the Passion narrative as the true disciples who understand that his ministry was not about rule and kingly glory, but about service and suffering and sacrifice. Fiorenza has also written about a short incident in chapter 14 of Mark's Gospel, the supper at Bethany, during which Jesus is anointed by an unnamed woman, to whom he responds by saying, "What she has done will be told in memory of her." And yet, this account has been virtually forgotten in biblical commentary in favor of the story of the Last Supper. So feminist theologians are making it their business to really hold up and dive into these tiny little snippets where women are talked about but not expanded on. They claim that there are undoubtedly many other stories with women as central characters which didn't even make it as far as being considered for inclusion by the original compilers of scripture, never mind making it through the process of putting together the finally accepted version. And so doing whatever is possible to reclaim the stories of women in the Bible is, I think, a necessary task. And because so little is written about them, this work sometimes has to be a work of interpolation between fragmentary clues in the text which has come down to us, and therefore needs some imaginative thinking, which of course some would not approve of, imaginative thinking in interpreting gospel stories. No, no, no. So at this stage, I'm not sure that I can accurately call myself a Christian. However, Christianity is my story, the place where I first encountered God and the possibility of reaching beyond the material world. And I'm not willing to let go of it and to allow it to be interpreted solely by those who want to sustain the status quo. I want to reclaim those stories in the gospel which speak to me as a woman, even if it needs some imagination to flesh out those stories. But my spirituality goes beyond Christianity as well. At the moment, I'm doing an online, via Zoom sort of thing, course of Sufi spirituality, and that is nurturing me deeply. My late aunt was an active member of a Hindu ashram in London for many years, probably in the 60s and 70s. I never talked to her in great depths about the particular beliefs of the ashram, and I know that she distanced herself from the community, but she continued for many years to use the spiritual practices and prayers and meditations which she had learnt there. And when I was staying with her, I was very struck by the fact that in times of uncertainty or petition, she made offerings of flowers and incense to the goddess on her little altar. I'm not sure about which goddess in particular in the Indian pantheon, but that's not important. What's important is the experience that as a woman and as a mother, she could come to the goddess, relate to the goddess about the deepest things in her life, which she probably couldn't do in the same way to a male image of God. This was an experiential and not an intellectual act. And to finish, I want to share with you some of her own words about her experience of the goddess. She wrote this: "I really believe nothing, except that belief is not required. Only experience counts. So after the incense and the little gift of flowers, somehow I notice, I experience deep, far away, like a glimmer within, a tiny sense of having come home. I experience this. Fortunately, I have no need to account for it." Words of my dear aunt, J. Mattingly. Amen.